Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Christine Fair, who's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies within the Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School for Foreign Service. Previously, she served as a political officer to the United Nations Assistant Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul, and as a senior research associate in the United States Institute for Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Fair.
Hey, thank you for having me back.
And since we last spoke, there's been some major developments. Of course, the most serious, I guess, was the recent clash on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan that resulted in the death of 24 Pakistani soldiers. My understanding from talking to people in Washington who know what's going on is that, in fact, the reason that President Obama has not apologized, as the Pakistanis have demanded, he has said that they regret, and NATO said they regret the loss of life, but he has not apologized because it was the Pakistanis' post that opened fire first on the NATO and Afghan soldiers. Is that your understanding?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, of course, that's what's being said, but I do want to make it very clear that we're probably not really going to know what has happened, right? This isn't the first time that this has happened. The very first episode that came to public life was in June of 2008 when U.S. soldiers operating under NATO fired upon several frontier corpsmen on Pakistani territory, killed lots of folks. And what typically happens in these things is that it's very embarrassing for the Pakistan government. It's very difficult for the U.S. government and NATO, because we're so dependent upon Pakistan for resupply, that what we typically do, or what we have done in the past, is come up with some story which is mutually inconvenient. Sometimes it looks like, yes, we mistook you for Taliban. There's some issue of an apology. Usually there is some mutually both exculpatory as well as embarrassing story that allows both sides to get on with things. So I'm not confident that we're ever going to know what happened, because to put that forward, I think, would be very embarrassing for the Pakistanis. And if these early reports are untrue, obviously very embarrassing for NATO. That being said, this is the most litigious war that I think this country's ever fought. And the rules of engagement are so tight that it really takes an extraordinary leap of insanity to think that somehow NATO, using standoff weapons, fired at these Pakistani positions without any provocation. The other interesting thing to note is that prior to firing on the positions from which NATO forces were taking fire, NATO actually contacted, per protocol, Pakistani military headquarters, army headquarters, and gave those coordinates and said, we're getting fire. We're going to be putting ordnance on those positions. Do you have troops there? And the Pakistani said no. So, you know, in essence, not only did the Pakistani side fire first, we also had clearance. NATO actually had clearance to fire on those positions from the Pakistani authorities. So you can imagine Pakistan doesn't really want to get to the bottom of this. They just want to make political and as well as military authorities there simply want to make a lot of hay out of this.
Well, they are making a lot of hay in the Pakistani press. And just recently, a Pew survey said that only 12% of Pakistanis expressed a favorable view of the United States. Now, that's before this incident. How low can it go?
Oh, I mean, I imagine that's probably even an overestimate. You know, Pakistan, I've been going to Pakistan now since 1991, which now I think about it, that's 20 years or something. You know, Pakistanis have never been terribly enthusiastic about Americans for as long as I've been going there. Remember, I went there right after the first Gulf War. But, you know, the problem with this relationship is that one of the worst partners in this is Pakistan's intelligence agency, the ISI. They are that organization is the architect of Pakistan's jihad under the nuclear umbrella. The organization controls, to a very considerable degree, Pakistani media. And it's able to, through the news anchors as well as the various print journal, so-called journalists that it pays, it's able to manipulate the media pretty effectively. And so what you saw in the aftermath of this attack was not waiting to understand what exactly happened, possibly exploring the possibility that Pakistan precipitated this in one way or another, or that, you know, there was some rational explanation for this. The Director General of the Inner Services Public Relations Organization, which is the spokesperson of the armed forces in Pakistan came out and said this was a deliberate, unprovoked American aggression on Pakistani forces. So what you see is there is no intention to on the Pakistani side to understand what happened. They're simply using this as yet another opportunity to make working with United States to make it difficult for the U.S. to work with Pakistan and to keep ratcheting up the price of Pakistan's so-called facilitation of the war on terror.
So, Chris Fair, would the recent recall and firing of the Pakistani ambassador to the United States, who appeared to have been caught in something of a sting, be another example of the ISI's influence over policy and how they use fair means or foul? I mean, I remember years ago speaking with this fellow, Mansour Ijaz, on a number of occasions, until I got the sense that he was ISI, or at least some kind of an asset, and stopped talking to him. But it looks like he set the ambassador up. Is that your understanding?
Well, boy, the Memogate, as it's known in South Asia, is really complicated. You know, for those folks who know Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, the man is often the smartest person in the room. The insight that after bin Laden was the time to bring the army and the ISI to its knees was really spot on. I mean, you'll never have an opportunity when the army was so disgraced and just in low regard among Pakistanis who woke up on the morning of May 2nd just whipsawed. I was actually there that week. I arrived 2 days after bin Laden was killed, you know, completely apropos of another commitment. And you could just see how dazed Pakistanis were and just how just disgusted they were at their army's incompetence. So the whole stratagem, which was to basically bring the United States in under the premise of a potential coup to further weaken the army in the ISI and to strengthen civilian leadership there with the premise that somehow those civilians would be more capable and competent in their commitment to fighting terrorism, is in of itself, A, not a bad idea, and it sure is not treason. But what you saw was that GHQ had the day. GHQ had him withdrawn. He's now been put on what Pakistan calls the export control list. He may be tried for treason. And it's preposterous. Pakistan's a parliamentary democracy. And how is it that asking the primary benefactor, Pakistan's military, to help undo the benefit that is bestowed upon that organization to help strengthen civilians, how in the world is that treasonous? So I see the withdrawal of Haqqani and the things that he is now fighting to be very much a sign of GHQ's prowess. And then, of course, the woman that will replace him is an incredibly brave woman. The woman's got cojones. But that being said, just because she's a civil society darling, just because she is incredibly brave and has taken on the bigots who would like to have this horrific blasphemy law, doesn't mean that she's not very much favored by the army. In fact, some of her recent publications with a very pro-Pakistan military individual at USIP, Moeed Youssef, sort of demonstrate that she is not distasteful or unpalatable to GHQ. Quite the contrary, she's very much a consensus candidate. She's going to appeal to Americans, but she's also going to be keeping Pakistan military's interests front and center as well.
Clearly, the Pakistan military, who receive over a quarter of its budget from the United States, they've always been in contest with the civilian authorities. But my understanding is that Imran Khan, the cricket hero, his party is gaining in popularity, and they're even more anti-American than the ISI is. It would seem so.
Well, okay, so Imran Khan is, of course, a puzzling fellow. I mean, he had quite a reputation for being a rakish Lothario and had quite a good time of doing things that would, qualify you for that reputation. Now he has turned the corner and he is embracing his life as a pious Muslim, or so he's saying, although there are a lot of people that are very dubious about his claims to his newfound piety. Many of the people in his party are allegedly activists from the Jamaat Islami. he has really come out of nowhere. And one has to be very suspicious when a politician in Pakistan comes out of nowhere, because that usually means that they're being propelled by the army and the ISI. And this is what, for example, happened with Nawaz Sharif. He was very much a product of GHQ and the ISI. He has a lot of things that appeal to the ISI. First of all, he's not President Zardari or the PPP. They have, obviously the GHQ can't stand that man. They also do not like the Pakistan Muslim League. Remember, after all, it was Nawaz Sharif that tried to dismiss Musharraf, and of course that played out dangerously in a coup that saw him being removed from power. So the first advantage that he has is that he is neither of those things. He is very willing to be very vocally anti-American. Now, when he has these interviews in English, he'll say, I'm not anti-West. I spent a good chunk of my life in my West. Of course, he doesn't say it, like sleeping around and womanizing and boozing in the West. But he says, I'm not anti-West. I'm not anti-American. I just don't want us to be your slave. So now when he says this in English, he sounds much more, with what I'm looking for, even keeled. He's not trying to alienate the West, but he's trying to reset relations. However, when you listen to the things that he says to his rallies in Urdu, I don't terribly feel confident that he is saying both things in both languages with the same intention. He's been very conciliatory towards the Pakistan Taliban. He opposes military operations against them. He has had a very bizarre position on Pakistan's blasphemy law. He has not outright denounced it. What he has said is that he has big issues with some politicians making political gains out of it. Given that politicians suffer the penalty of death for raising it, it's hard for me to characterize anyone's position as being able to make political gains out of opposing or even suggesting the blasphemy be reformed. So I think he's someone that we should be watching for, because I think the army likes him. They no longer have a coup. All they have to do is prorogue the government, rig elections, and put him in some sort of weak coalition where he's the head of a king's party.
So just in the last few minutes then, Chris, Claire, clearly the relationship between the U.S. and NATO and the Pakistani military, these are friends without benefits. And in effect, there's a protection.
Well, they're not even friends.
Right. Well, but we're operating along the basis of a kind of protection racket that's not working. And now they pulled the plug on the supplies.
Actually, that's not true, Ian. This sort of reveals the venal kabuki theater that is Pakistani domestic politics. What they have done is they have said the G-locks will be closed. Now, in the past, they've closed them for up to 3 weeks. Why do they open it for 3 weeks? Because, as you said, the protection racket wants its money, right? Any dedicated insurgent would be sitting there at the border points blowing up trucks. Pilferage, overall loss between 1% and 5%. Really what's happening is the Pashtun Mafia controls that. The National Logistics Cell, which is a part of the Pakistan military, everyone's making a lot of money off of this. So I don't really see it closing. But one thing that people haven't mentioned, which is probably good from my point of view, is that the only thing that's being discussed are the ground lines of control. We are flying so many flights over Pakistani airspace over the last year and change. We've decreased the amount of lethal goods and other things that are necessary for Afghanistan traveling on Pakistan's roads, and we've basically replaced that with air traffic. And then we are trying to bring things into the northern distribution route, but the Russians won't let us move things that are lethal, and obviously you need lethal products to wage a war. The other thing that they've been howling about, a very long-standing drama, is over the drones, right? We've been basing these drones out of Pakistan territory. Their forces protect our forces on those bases. And now they are quote, that we are requesting the Americans to vacate Shamsi. What is not mentioned, of course, is that we actually have drones at two bases. So this is basically the Pakistan military trying to wrench as many concessions out of the Americans while placating their public. They're not shutting down the logistics. They've been very selective in discussing how they do this.
So just in closing then, what is the likelihood of making a deal with the Russians? I mean, you go from one mafia payoff to another, wouldn't you?
Well, look, I don't follow U.S.-Russian relations very closely, so I'm not the right person to discuss this with. But as it pertains to Afghanistan, we have a couple of issues. one, the likelihood of a U.S.-Russian reset isn't very likely with, you know, with Putin in his various Machiavellian maneuverings. And then the part of the problem with Russia and Afghanistan is that, of course, it has big issues with NATO. So this is Russia's position on the Northern Distribution Route is just as much to corner us and to put us into a problematic position as it is NATO. And obviously, the Russians aren't terribly thrilled about our presence in Afghanistan, right? They really don't want there to be any sort of contest of wills between the Americans and the Russians in the Central Asian states that abut Afghanistan.
But they don't want the Taliban to win, though, do they?
You know, look, they're kind of like Iran. They don't want the Taliban to win, but they certainly don't want to make certainly don't want to make things easier for the Americans. And so it's
Schadenfreude, then.
It's totally Schadenfreude. They don't want the complete region to go to hell in a handbasket because they have to clean it up. But on the other hand, Russia has enough buffers, right? There's, you know, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, you know, all the Central Asian republics will sort of buffer it. And then, as you said, we've got Russian mafia interests, right? The Russian mafia are very much involved in the narco trafficking that comes out of Afghanistan. So it's not as simple as they don't want us to win or they don't want us to lose. It's just that multiple entities involve NATO countries, Russia, United States, non-state actors. They all have different equities, and everyone is trying to jointly optimize, given certain constraints that exist in the system.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Christine Fair.
Thank you. Have a wonderful afternoon.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies within the Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. Previously, she served as a political officer to the United Nations Assistant Mission in Afghanistan in Kabul, and as a senior research associate in the United States Institute for Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began, went to Cairo, Egypt, to get an update on the Egyptian elections, where the Salafists did extremely well with over 24%. The vote, that's the Muslim fundamentalists funded by the Saudis, and the Muslim Brotherhood did 37%. Together, they obviously have a substantial majority. Our guest, Yasmin El-Rashidi, who wrote the e-book, The Battle for Egypt, she says that, in fact, the liberals and the military will probably have some kind of rapprochement because she doesn't think that anybody particularly wants Egypt to become an Iran or a Saudi Arabia. If that is indeed the wishes, it is the wishes of the Salafists for sure, and that the real battle is coming up now in the parliament about writing a new constitution. And then once that's done, there will be, of course, the presidential elections. And she thinks, again, it's likely not to be a Muslim fundamentalist, but a more secular person that will eventually be the president. Then Julie Levine joined us in the studio. She's been with Occupy LA movement from the beginning. She really went to town on the LAPD and the sheriffs, citing any number of brutality and abuses. Chapter and verse, she walked us through what happened to all of these protesters when they're arrested, and painted an extremely bleak picture of police brutality, out of sight, out of mind, in spite of the fact that everybody's celebrating how well the mayor of Los Angeles handled the event and the eviction of the tent city at City Hall. She said, out of sight, out of mind, in the police buses, etc. A whole different story took place. And then I was joined by Chris Fair, one of the leading experts on Pakistan. She speaks the language, knows the people, goes there a lot. She's somebody who really does know what she's talking about. She said that, in fact, the 24 Pakistani soldiers who were recently killed, they initiated fire first. NATO then asked for permission from the Pakistani military to retaliate, and they were given permission. So there's a whole lot more to that story than what we've heard so far. But clearly, the Pakistanis hold the cards and are essentially running a protection racket. And Uncle Sam, of course, once again, will have to be Uncle Soccer. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.